Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have a lot on health and healing and why you should be using tahini more often. Also, the American Dental Association suggests you use fluoride. Well, we disagree. We have the facts and the truth to share with you. Also today, we'll be looking at nutrients that can improve your heart and your brain. And green tea actually makes your teeth stronger. Folic acid helps heal your brain. And why women with diabetes develop more cancer. Then we're going to take a look at drug companies killing kids for profit. That's according to Dr. Stuart Bramhall from Op-Ed News. Also, a special commentary looking at a totalitarian paranoia in the post-Orwellian surveillance state by Professor Henry Giroux. From Robert Burroughs, Nation of Change, why do we fear the truth? America's most dangerous pill, that's important, and if time permits, we're going to also look at patient front groups give our tax dollars to Big Pharma, Martha Rosenberg. I've been asked about the Federal Reserve too many times, so today I'm going to tell you why the Federal Reserve is not independent, nor apolitical, nor is it a government bank. I'll get into that and show you something you did not know that shows you its true character. My guest in the second part of our program will be Ray McGovern. He served as an Army intelligence officer and a CIA analyst under seven presidential administrations, from John F. Kennedy's White House to that of George Bush. Among his duties were preparing the president's daily brief, which was a one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisors. He was responsible for the analyst of Soviet intelligence regarding Vietnam. We're going to talk about a look at some of the important issues today, including our declining human rights in America, our declining free speech in America, the U.S. foreign policy hypocrisies, and the U.S. role in the collapse of the Ukraine. So you won't want to miss that. Let's begin. And also, I realize a lot of people listen to this program on the telephone. So in a second, I'm going to give you two phone numbers. It's very important you write these down. Because just look back to those of you who are listening now from the 30 years I was on WPFW. Had you not written down the numbers, then you would not have known that when I was off the air there because of my concern for you not receiving your premiums in a timely manner, and rather that being discussed, they simply stopped me from discussing it. So much for free speech. In any case, you had those numbers, many of you, and that's why you're listening now. So that's important. And think of just a few weeks ago on WBAI. Think of the people who, starting on a Monday, didn't hear the show, didn't know why you weren't hearing the show. And so as a result, you didn't know where we went. Well, 2 weeks later, we came back on. And then you had a chance to hear an in-depth explanation, which was on the, I gave that on, the Monday night program. I spent 2 hours on it just to give you as much comprehension on that as possible. So I'm going to wait a moment just so that you can have the opportunity to write it down. All right? So this way, if you ever turn on this air and you don't hear me, you'll know, okay, I'll call this number or this number and I'll get that. All right? Or you can always go to my website, GaryNull.com. You can always go to Progressive Radio Network because this is where we originate the show and syndicate it to all the stations all across the United States. Got a pencil and paper now? Write this number down. 401-347-0456. 401-347-0456 and 712-432-7231. 712-432-7231, because I can assure you that my time on this particular on the station, not Progressive Radio now, I'm going to be there for a long time, is tenuous. Let's begin. Now, a lot of you enjoy tahini, and if you come from the Middle East, virtually the entire Middle East has for hundreds of years used sesame seeds, and from the seed you make a paste and an oil. Both are extremely helpful. But here's why. According to the peer-reviewed archives of Iranian medicine, tahini is able to do what a lot of drugs like statin drugs, drugs prescribed for heart health, but have very dangerous side effects, but it can promote health significantly. And a study looked at the effects of tahini in type 2 diabetes, people who are known to be at a greater risk of cardiac death due to higher than normal blood lipids and high blood sugar and insulin resistance. And they found that the group that was given 28 grams, that's 1 ounce, 1 ounce, that's 1 teaspoon of tahini with their breakfast every day for 6 months, and another group didn't get tahini at all. And then they took a look at their health, and the group that got the tahini getting lowered blood pressure, lowered triglycerides, and lowered cholesterol. That is good. So one more reason to have good things like tahini into our diet. Quote, after 6 weeks, there was significant decreases in serum triglycerides, and moreover, a slight decrease in total cholesterol and the LDL cholesterol and other atherogenic lipid parameters. So 39% decrease, that's a big decrease. Also, it's been shown the oil, sesame seed oil, has been shown to benefit people with arthritis and do what the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen does, especially with knee arthritis. This was in the International Journal of Rheumatic Disease and showed that tahini, sesame seeds, the paste, the oil, makes a difference. The American Dental Association is recommending using fluoride on infants as young as 6 months. We have all the data on fluoride that shows that it will lower IQ, that it will suppress the immune system, that it's a known carcinogen. So here is what I'm suggesting. Just look at fluoride. Look at its history. Look at the actual independent science. In fact, when they put it on the bottle of mouthwash or on the toothpaste tube for appropriate use of fluoride, it's ironic given that even moderate fluoride ingestion, one part per million, that's what you find in a glass of water, has been found to be harmful. How so? Well, the chemical has actually been linked to contributing to lower intelligence. Researchers from Harvard University School of Public Health and China Medical University in Xinjiang, in a joint meta-analysis of 27 different studies, found that there was, quote, strong indications that fluoride exposure, particularly among developing children, is highly problematic regarding proper cognitive development and brain function. It's also been shown to be associated with bone cancer in boys. Britain's The Observer newspaper reported that a study by Harvard School of Dental Health and showed a link between an osteosarcoma and fluoride. Quote, this is a very specific cancer in a defined population of children. It also was found to damage your brain. According to Fluoride Action Network, 34 separate studies have found that even at levels in U.S. water supplies, fluoride can harm brain development. So, but there's a lot more. We have the definitive article up on our website, and along with about 70 other articles per day, these are the ones that give you the idea it works. What if you were to learn that a simple sugar pill, a placebo, had the same effects as most pharmaceutical drugs? Well, that's what Kim Evans of Natural News found out when doing some homework. And it's that dirty little secret that the pharmaceutical drug world would rather keep quiet. The fact is, quote, drugs are having a difficult time beating the placebo effect, and increasingly so In fact, they're finding the placebo effect is getting stronger in people, making it more difficult for drugs to show any improvement over it. The credit for the increased placebo effect has been attributed to an increase in consumer advertising, which makes many consumers believe more in the drugs and their effects. Because the placebo effect is getting stronger, many widely distributed drugs would have had a hard time getting approval to begin with, even if they were tested against today's placebo effect. Many drugs, notably Prozac, have also been shown to falter when compared to placebo. That means a sugar pill does better than Prozac. So, placebos win with a lot of drugs. The danger is a lot of these drugs are extremely expensive and they can kill people. Why is it that women with diabetes are more likely to develop cancer? This is from Tel Aviv University Medical School. They took a look at 17,000 diabetics, and they showed that the males were less likely to develop the cancers than females. And they also found that there was a 25% higher rate of cancer in females. Well, a lot of this is hormonal, because a lot of cancers are hormone-driven. Now, what will drive your hormones in the wrong direction to make you more susceptible to cancer? First, if you're overweight, that in itself increases your estrogen level. That can produce cancer. If you're highly stressed, that'll increase your estrogen rate, which can produce cancer. And if you're eating a lot of meat, like on a high-protein diet, that will also increase estrogen, which can promote cancer. I took a look for a new documentary that is complete. It's done. It's just sitting, waiting for the book that is going to accompany it. And hopefully this summer, I'll be able to premiere the film. But I was looking at the relationship between cancer, heart disease, diabetes, in a large group of men and women, but it was dominant in women who were vegan, healthy vegan versus meat eaters. And the healthy vegan women had the highest rate of protective phytochemicals in their body. They had the least amount of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, and depression. Those that ate the most meat had the highest levels of cancer and heart disease and diabetes and depression. There's a connection. I mentioned on a recent program that doctors didn't know how much folic acid to recommend, and some were recommending micrograms, which are virtually worthless. You need higher grams, or higher milligrams, 1 to 2 to 3 methylated milligrams of folic acid can make a big difference, can also help heal your brain. According to the University of Wisconsin and a research team, they took a look at folic acid and they found that it actually made a difference. It made a difference in spinal cord injuries, in helping them heal and healing the brain. So folic acid's really good, and green tea can make your tea stronger. The most common thought is that what in the world will green tea have to do with my teeth? It has a lot to do because of the polyphenols in it. I would suggest 200 to 400 milligrams for 1 to 2 cups of green tea non-caffeinated a day can make a big difference. And for those of you who have never used beet juice, raw beet juice is terrific for you. It can help dissolve stones in the liver, kidneys, and bladder, which are extremely, extremely painful. It is also able to lower high blood pressure, and substantially. It is also able to help cancer patients and break down, eliminate tumors. It's been shown to increase the body's production of glutathione, which helps the body detoxify cancer-causing poisons. And glutathione can grab onto hundreds of different kinds of environmental chemicals and pull them out of the colon, where they can be flushed down the toilet. So lower your cholesterol, have your fiber from beets, clean up your blood with beet juice. drop your cholesterol, your triglycerides, both, with beets. We don't eat beets in the United States. We never juice beets in the United States, and we should. I mentioned that for when you start measuring a drug, they almost always measure a drug by another drug. Well, that's not a placebo. According to ABC News, quote, a new analysis found that commonly prescribed antidepressants had, quote, little effect on people with cases of mild to severe depression compared to those treated with a placebo. Now, this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it was from six different studies, and they looked at Paxil, Prozac, and Zoloft, and some of the older antidepressants. Quote, the magnitude of benefit of antidepressant medication compared with placebo increases with severity of depression symptoms and may be minimal or non-existent on average in patients with mild to moderate symptoms. Well, that tells it all, since most people are mild to moderate. And therefore, good social conversations with someone who is skilled in the field can make all the difference in the world. So think of the side effects. They are severe. Now, that brings me to several other issues. One is a front group that ends up sponsoring Big Pharma. That's why today you got to look at every nonprofit. You have to look at who funds them, where they get their money. Because a lot of corporations realize the public has become, disengaged from them. They no longer trust them. No longer believe them, because they know that profit's their number one incentive, and they'll lie in every way they can to get you to take their drugs, to vote for them, whatever it is. This is from Martha Rosenberg. Quote, the Obama administration is finally addressing the expensive, dangerous, and usually unnecessary psychiatric drugs that are footed by taxpayers and federal entitlement programs. It has proposed that insurers may limit Medicare coverage of certain classes of drugs that include Wellbutrin, Paxil, Prozac for depression, and Abilify and Seroquel for schizophrenia. By the way, let them prove to you that schizophrenia is real. Let them prove to you that it's a brain chemical imbalance. They can't because the science is not there. How expensive are these drugs? Just 100 dose pills marketed by on the product Abilify cost $1,644. 100 pills of Geodon, $958. Invega, $1,789. Risperdal, $953. Seroquel, $2,000. Zyprexa, $1,680. So if the brand name of the drugs are used, which drug company lobbyists hope, then people say, oh, I saw that advertised on television. But thanks to the lobbying, insurers have to pay, quote, all or substantially all of such depression and schizophrenia drug costs because the drug companies enjoy protected status in the Medicare program. And that means that we're paying for it. Big Pharma and its patient front groups are livid that the U.S. taxpayer dollars could be curtailed. Why? Because just Abilify alone earned them $4 billion a year. So why can't we buy the generic version? I don't believe in any of these drugs. I don't believe any of them are necessary. But even if they were, why not just go out and buy them instead of for $1,680 for Zyprexa, why not spend about $2, what it cost? And that's the big scam. 2 years ago, in a documentary called The Prescription for Disaster, we managed to find documents showing the actual cost of manufacturing the 10 leading drugs in the United States. And there was upwards of a 500,000% margin of profit over the generic 30-day supply. I saw a bottle of drugs in the top 10 30 pills that cost about 12 cents that we're selling for $180. That's why Big Pharma owns everything, because they don't want people knowing the true cost, and they don't want to have to have us be able to buy drugs inexpensively. And there are front groups out there that are they're promoting these, you know, and they'll go before Congress saying, we represent all these patients and we need these drugs, and if you curtail them in any way, it could affect us. Well, how about this? How about the 15,000 senior citizens who die in nursing homes every year from inappropriately given antipsychotic medications? That's according to the FDA reviewer, Dr. David Graham. So Big Pharma is aware of this. They don't care. They're making their money. It's all ka-ching to them. So that's what we got to know. And any of the front groups that are, you see on television saying, but we need these drugs, almost all of them are set up by Big Pharma, and people are paid a lot of money to go around and propagandize and to testify on Capitol Hill. So don't trust them until you find out who's behind them. One big scandal that's out there I'd like your feedback on. I'm going to give it to you now, and I'd like for you to call in. We have right now 1.6 million school children who do not have a home to go to when they get out of school each day. They're homeless. We have 9.3 million homes that are underwater, and those people will likely be losing their home, and that's about four people per home. So you're looking around anywhere from 35 to 40 million Americans. We've already dispossessed over 40 million Americans. So that would make, within the next 2 years, a total of over 90 million Americans having lost their homes. And that's amazing, because it's the same in Europe, not the same numbers, but it's the same problem. But here's what people don't understand. This is in Europe alone. More than 11 million homes lie empty across Europe. And yet, the homeless are not allowed in any of them. In Spain, there's 3.4 million homes vacant. 2 million are empty in France, 1.8 million. And in Germany, 700,000 in the United Kingdom. In Ireland, Greece, Portugal, several other countries, empty. Now, the majority of these homes were actually built during the boom years, in 2006, 2005, and they've been empty. They were never meant to be lived in. They're completed. I mean, if you go through some, and I have, if you go through some of these towns, every single home in the town is empty. It was an entire resort, an entire home built on the ocean for speculation. You pay a certain amount to get in, you get an insider's fee, and then a year or two later, you sell it, you triple your money, whatever percent you make. And yet the governments are not doing anything to help the people who don't have a place to stay. What does it say when you got 11 million homes that is more than enough for every homeless person in Europe to have a place to stay? So, and then half-built homes that could have been finished have been bulldozed because they wanted to keep the price of the existing homes up. Now, let me just give you this insight. We've been told by the talking heads on television that we have an uptick in the real estate market. It's looking really strong, really good. That's a lie. First of all, just use common sense. Who do you think are the people most likely to buy a home and historically have? Young people graduating from college and wanting to start a family. And they did. That's the largest single group. Parents coming out of the Second World War, the baby boomers, they started their family. We're the largest generation in American history. And as a result, people bought on the GI loan inexpensive homes. The average cost was $8,000. People who are very wealthy want multiple homes, and generally they're buying them in exclusive areas like Aspen and out in the oceans, communities like Malibu or West Palm Beach, and or in gated communities. And there are millions, about 20 to 30 million Americans living in gated communities. Now, I'm not arguing that a person doesn't have a right to buy a home and live wherever they want. You do. That's your right. You earned your money. You worked hard. You deserve to spend it the way you want. But what about all the people who've lost their homes? That should never have happened. They could have put a moratorium on home foreclosures. They chose not to. They could have helped bring the cost of the mortgage down to the value of the property. That would have saved 90% of the homes. They chose not to. But what you haven't known is who's been buying up these foreclosed homes. It's not individuals. It's investment companies, speculative investment companies like hedge funds and equity partnerships, because they'll go in and buy up hundreds of homes in an area, and they rent them out. Or then they put them into investment pools, and just like they did with the subprime, it's being done all over again, creating another bubble. They also are connected with the banks, and therefore the banks are keeping what is called the shadow economy of all this real estate. By keeping all of this real estate off the market, it keeps the value of the ones that are on the market higher. And also, these people are really ruthless. So that is why you've had an uptick in the value of property. It's not that Americans have regained employment, have savings, have a bright future. To the contrary, look at the industries that have not rebounded: the building, landscaping, appliances, carpets, hardwood floors, shingles, siding, concrete. All the people who come in and build a home, those are all still in a very bad way. And massive amounts of those people have had to go on to other work because the work's dried up. So that's the reality of it. And it's only going to get worse. This bubble will burst. Now, one bubble that should burst is our belief that the Federal Reserve is anything other than a criminal organization. It is a criminal organization. Let me tell you something you did not know. I bet no one in this audience knew. But it's been uncovered from the Southern Economic Journal. Documents show that the Federal Reserve offered to bail out Mexico if it would agree to join the North American Trade Agreement, NAFTA. Free trade deals have nothing to do with the Fed's mandate. But that's how it works. So who got bailed out when the peso was shorted and crashed? Well, now you know. The Fed was behind there. The Fed has been behind giving $16.3 trillion to only 22 corporations in amounts that are staggering, that have never been discussed in front of Congress, like $2.3 trillion to Bank of America, $2.1 trillion to Citicorp, $884 billion to Goldman Sachs, etc. Not only national, American, but foreign banks. And yet, the Fed won't give a dollar, not a dollar, to a small business person. And I've advocated for a long time, if the Fed would give just $5 trillion with the same low interest rates to small businesses, if the small business agreed that for every $1 million it received, it had to hire a person at a living wage, let's say $25, you would then be able to employ 6 to 7 million Americans. And that money then would be enough for them to have one job instead of having to work two, and they would have some savings. And then that would go into the local economy, and you start to regain strength in local economies. But it doesn't. It gives that money to major corporations. For example, the Fed is not independent. It's owned by the 12 regional banks that are controlled by stockholders. Look for the Rothschild Group. Look for the Rockefeller Group. Look for the wealthiest families in the world. Not to put their name on anything, but they know that you can control a corporation by controlling shares of stock and preferred stock and voting stock and getting your people on their board of directors. That's how it works. And hence, they control the direction. The Fed is utterly corrupt. The Fed has given money, quote, to several billionaires and tens of millionaires, including billionaire businessman H. Wayne Huizenga, billionaire Michael Dell of Dell Computers, billionaire hedge fund manager John Paulson, billionaire private equity honcho J. Christopher Flowers, and the wife of Morgan Stanley CEO John Mack. The Fed also bailed out wealthy corporations, including hedge funds, McDonald's, and Harley-Davidson. The Fed has been bailing out foreign banks more than Main Street or the American people. The foreign banks bailed out by the Fed include Gaddafi's Libyan Bank, the Arab Banking Corporation of Bahrain, and the banks of Bavaria, Korea, and Mexico. And the Fed's main program for dealing with financial crisis just print massive amounts of money. We call it quantitative easing. No, it's money laundering. And it benefits only the rich and hurts everyone else. So that's what we have in the Fed. We should close down the Fed and we should allow the Treasury to print our money at zero interest, and that would save us $700 billion a year. Now, before we go to my guest in about 7 or 8 minutes, the revelations of whistleblowers such as Chelsea Manning and Jeremy Hammond and Edward Snowden about government lawlessness and corporate spying provide a new meaning, if not a revitalized urgency and relevancy to George Orwell's dystopian fable 1984. Orwell offered his readers an image of the modern state that had become dystopian, one in which privacy as a civil virtue and a crucial right was no longer valued as a measure of the robust strength of a healthy and thriving democracy. Orwell was clear that the right to privacy had come under egregious assault, but the right to privacy pointed to something more sinister than the violation of individual rights. When ruthlessly transgressed, the issue of privacy became a moral and political principle by which to assess the nature, power, and severity of an emerging totalitarian state. As important as Orwell's warning was in shedding light on the horrors of the mid-20th century totalitarianism and the endless regimes of state spying imposed on citizens, the text serves as a brilliant but limited metaphor for mapping the expansive trajectory of global surveillance and authoritarianism now characteristic of the first decades of the new millennial. It was Marjorie Cohen who said, "Orwell could never have imagined that the National Security Agency would amass metadata on billions of our phone calls and over 200 million of our text messages every day. Orwell could not have foreseen that our government would read the content of our mails, file transfers, and live chats from the social media we use." In his videotape message recently, Snowden referenced Orwell's warning of the dangers of microphones, video cameras, and TV that watch us. Yes, allowing the state to regulate the subjects within the most intimate spaces of private life. But these older modes of surveillance that Snowden elaborates, however, are nothing compared to what is used to infringe on our present privacy today. For Snowden, the threat posed by the new surveillance state can be measured by its reach and use of technologies that far outdate anything Orwell envisioned and pose a much greater threat to the privacy rights of citizens and the reach of sovereign powers. He reiterates this point by reminding his viewers that a child born today will grow up with no conception of privacy at all. They will never know what it means to have a private moment to themselves, an unrecorded, unanalyzed thought. Snowden is right about the danger to privacy rights, but his analysis fails to go far enough in linking together the question of surveillance with the rise of networked societies. What do I mean by that? I mean global flows of power and the emergence of a totalitarian fascistic state. Surveillance has become a growing feature of daily life. In fact, it is more appropriate to analyze the culture of surveillance rather than address exclusively the violations committed by the corporate surveillance state. In this instance, the surveillance and security state is one that not only listens and watches and gathers massive amounts of information through data mining necessary for identifying consumer populations, but also accumulates enough that then it acculturates the public into accepting the intrusion of surveillance technologies and privatized, commodified values into all aspects of our lives. Personal information is willingly given over to social media and other corporate-based websites and gathered daily as people move from one targeted website to the next across multiple screens and digital apparatuses. As Ariel Dorfman points out, social media users gladly give up their liberty and privacy. Yes, they do. Invariably, for the most benevolent of platitudes and reasons. All the while, endlessly shopping online and texting. The average person texts over 300 times a day. This collecting of information might be most evident in the video cameras that inhabit every public space, from the streets and commercial establishments and workplaces to the schools our children attend, as well as in the myriad scanners placed at the entry points of airports, stores, sporting events, everywhere. And yet the most important transgression may not only be happening through an unwarranted watching, listening, and collecting of information, but also in a culture that normalizes surveillance by upping the pleasure point and enticements for consumers who use the new digital technologies and social networks to stimulate false notions of community and to stimulate the socialization of young people into a culture of security and commodification in which their identities, their values, their desires are tied to the culture of private addictions and self-help and commodification. Surveillance feeds on the related notions of fear and delusion. Authoritarianism and its contemporary manifestations, as evidenced so grippingly in Orwell's text, no longer depend upon raw displays of power, but instead has become omnipotent in a culture of control in which the most cherished notions of agency collapse into unabashed narcissistic exhibitions and confessions of the self, serving as willing fodder for the spying state. The self has become not simply the subject of surveillance, but a willing participant and object, operating off the assumption that some individuals will not willingly turn their private lives over to the spying state, and corporations, the National Security Agency, and other intelligence agencies work hard to create a turnkey authoritarian state in which the electronic self becomes public property. Every space is now enclosed within the purview of an authoritarian society that attempts to govern the entirety of social life. And that's how it works. In conclusion, social cynicism and societal indifference accelerate a broken culture in which reason has been replaced by consumer-fed hallucinatory hopes. Surveillance and its accompanying culture of fear now produce subjects that revel in being watched, turning the practice, if not the threat posed by surveillance, into just another condition for performing the self. Every human act and behavior is now potential fodder for the YouTube, Facebook, or some other social network. Privacy has become a curse, an impediment that subverts the endless public display of the self. Everything that moves is monitored, along with information that is endlessly amassed and stored by private and government agencies. No one, it seems, can escape the tentacles of the national security state or the spy agencies that are scouring mobile phone apps for personal data and intercepting computer and cell phone shipments to plant tracking devices and malware in them. Surveillance is now global, reaching beyond borders that no longer provide an obstacle to collecting information and spying on governments, individuals, prominent politicians, corporations, pro-democracy protest groups. The details of the daily lives of everyone on the planet are on full display, but are being monitored, collected, and stored in databases, waiting to be used for commercial, security, or political purposes. At the same time, the right to privacy is eagerly given up by millions of people for the wonders of social networking, or the varied seductions inspired by consumer fantasies. The loss of privacy and anonymity and confidentiality also has the adverse effect of providing the basis for what Bauman and David Lenz call the undemocratic process of social sorting, in which different populations are subject to different treatment, extending from being protected by the state to being killed by drone attacks launched under the auspices of global surveillance and state power. Privacy is no longer a principled and cherished civil right. On the contrary, it has been absorbed and transformed within the purview of a celebrity and market-driven culture in which people publicize themselves and their innermost secrets to promote and advance their own personal narcissistic brand. Or it is so often a principle invoked by conservatives who claim their rights to privacy have been trampled upon when confronted with ideas or arguments that unsettle their notions of common sense or their worldviews. It is worth repeating that privacy has mostly become synonymous with a form of self-generated nonstop performance, a type of public relations. That's what it is at this moment. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with our guest. Please stay with us.
Day after day, I'm more confused. Yet I look for the light through the pouring rain. You know that's a game that I hate to lose. I'm feeling the strain. Ain't it a shame? Oh, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I wanna get lost in your rock and roll and drift away. Oh, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I wanna get
welcome
lost
all of you. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go to Northern Virginia and say hello to Ray McGovern. I gave you his biographical background earlier on in the program, and He holds degrees in theology and philosophy from Fordham University. He's a graduate of Harvard Business School and has a certificate of theology from Georgetown University. The website is raymcgovern.com, and as well as consortiumnews.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Great to be with you, Gary.
Because of the upcoming trial, I know that there'll be things that you cannot divulge since you have sued John Kerry and some of the other people involved in what happened to you, but also because you're a person that speaks the truth in ways most people formerly of government never do, I'd like you to take us through what has happened in this society, first to you in the case in point where you stood up, turn your back, and in just a quiet, nonviolent way, when Secretary of State Clinton was talking about human rights and how we should protect them, in full view of her, you were arrested and beaten, and yet no one seemed to have seen the irony in that. I do, and I want you to discuss that. And then right now, the United States seems almost certain with evidence that the U.S. government is supporting al-Qaeda terrorists in Syria. We remain closely allied with Israel and their apartheid and human rights crimes against the Palestinians. We are aligned in supporting neo-Nazi fascist groups in the Ukraine. And now we are also clearly behind the aristocratic families in Venezuela who are trying to oust President Maduro's nationalist government. Again, we aid and abet totalitarian and regressive fascistic individuals and groups simply because, and then you'll fill in the dots there. And also, it is my belief that one of the reasons that we have supported the fascists in the overthrow of the government in the Ukraine is because we'd love to get NATO in there by getting the Ukraine to become a member of NATO and get it to become a member of the European Union. So then we could bring our military in there and have a base right at Russia's doorsteps. That's my own views. I don't have hard proof of that, but it's just I see how our government works. Could you take these issues on, please?
Sure. I think you're dead right, Gary, on the overreach of our neoconservative policymakers. But this time, they're not going to be able to succeed. I know a little bit about Russia. That was my specialization. They're not going to let NATO anywhere near the Ukraine. So what we have here is the makings of a prolonged struggle, and unless NATO backs off, as they promised Gorbachev way back when, you know, we might we might incorporate some of the East European countries into NATO, but we promise we will not incorporate any of the constituent republics that used to be part of the Soviet Union. So, without sounding like an advocate of Putin and what the Russians are doing, it is a violation of our promise, and it's very crassly designed to expand our reach. And as I say, this is beyond what the Russians will tolerate. It's their ballpark, their playing field. It's their near territory, and they're going to meet this with a lot of power. Now, with respect to what you mentioned earlier, Gary, about the complaint that has been filed by a nonprofit law firm called the Partnership for Civil Rights Fund, they took up my case when I was beaten and carried out of George Washington University 3 years ago simply for standing with my back to Hillary Clinton, not very far away, without saying a word and looking in the back, just peacefully standing there. I couldn't conceive of a more peaceful, less hostile, or less rambunctious display of dissonance with what she was saying, because it was incredibly hypocritical. The speech was about the right to dissidence, and of course he was talking about Iran, and it was just like something out of Franz Kafka to have exactly when she was talking about these things, me carried out right in front of her. People say, she didn't miss a word, did she? Well, she didn't miss a syllable. Finally, this Partnership for Civil Justice Fund has filed a complaint, a violation of my First Amendment rights, unlawful police and misconduct, Fourth Amendment rights, excessive force and wrongful arrest, and also the lawyers found out that I had been investigated by the State Department for 7 months, even though they had determined that I had no previous record and there was no reasonable cause to do that. And they issued something they call a BOLO order, be aware or be on the lookout for McGovern, and if you see him, stop him and question him. Now, that clearly is a Fourth Amendment issue, and that's going to come forward now. And the police at George Washington University, the State Department with whom they cooperated or took orders from, the George Washington University itself are all named in this suit. It's kind of poetic justice that this comes at this time, because I think people can have a visual demonstration of, let's put it this way, of Hillary Clinton's reaction to innocent suffering when it's just 20, 30 yards in front of her. That should be a telling indication to folks. Gary, I'd like to comment on your eloquent introduction here about the snooping, about NSA running amok.
Sure, please do.
There are so many people, so many people who say, well, I don't care. You know, I've got nothing to hide, you know. Well, one of my favorite recent quotes is from a fellow named Wolfgang Schmidt, okay, a high officer in the East German Stasi, the state's police. They're the ones that many of your audience probably saw in Das Leben der Anderen, the Lives of Others. And he was a high official that kind of executed the policy of the Stasi. And he commented as follows. He said, it is extremely, extremely naive to suggest that there's no risk and that the governments will not use this data that's collected on people. Because that's what secret organs of government do. And to suggest that it would not be used that way is not only naive, but it's very, very dangerous, because as night follows the day, they're going to use it, and the only way to prevent them from using it is to prevent them from collecting it. Now, the violations of the Fourth Amendment are rather crass. You know, what I've been doing, Gary, if you'll permit me a minute to recite the Fourth Amendment, it's only one sentence, but it speaks volumes, literally, and it has a heritage from those times under the colonies, under the British rule, where general warrants were issued and British soldiers could come in at any house or any place and seize what they wished. Here's the Fourth Amendment. The rights of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause supported by oath and affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Well, is there probable cause that we're all terrorists, Gary? Is there probable cause that we're all engaged in some sort of criminal activity? Because that's the requirement here. And where is the oath or affirmation? Where are the warrants that are supposed to, quote, particularly describe the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized? Well, this is a gross violation of that Fourth Amendment, and people are beginning to see that now. And there's no way around it by saying, well, the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act lets that happen. Well, I was on the radio early this morning, and I talked about illegal laws. And the interviewer said, well, wait a second. That's an oxymoron. You can't have illegal laws. Well, you can. And that's exactly what they had under the Third Reich in the 30s in Germany. They had a constitution there. And that didn't matter. They made illegal laws. Now, that all came to a very bad end. In this case, in our case, I'm hopeful that even though large portions of the Congress are complicit in this gross violation of the Fourth Amendment, there is still a judiciary. Now, the judiciary didn't have a chance to work in Germany, but has a chance to work now. And I have a lot of hope that finally there'll be enough people that have the respect for our Constitution that I do, it will say, look, this is clearly beyond what our founders intended. You need to stop it, and you need to stop it now.
I appreciate that. My last important question deals with something that the public is not aware of. I'm not aware of anyone who knows what you know on this. And I put this out as a hypothesis. You can fill in the blanks. Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS, managed a detailed memo for the president on January 7th, 10 days before he spoke, four veterans retired, a veteran National Security Agency senior officials with a cumulative experience of 144 years, that's 36 years each, leveled with the president in that January 7th memo in an extraordinarily straightforward way, which, of course, has been enabled by Snowden's disclosures. Either A, Obama is not telling the truth on some very key related issues, and, for example, is he being played, manipulated by General Alexander, Jim Clapper, John Brennan, or whether he's simply lying? He knows the truth, but unable to face up to the eavesdroppers out of fear. And then blackmail. This is only one of the cudgels that have you could use against a person, including even a president. J. Edgar Hoover used it on everyone, including the president. So tell us about what was in that memo from this group of former top-level national security advisors and why it's important to the American public. Talk to them, read the memo, and know the truth.
Well, this is really quite astounding that they're able to say these things now, largely because of what Ed Snowden revealed. What happened here is that these four National Security Agency officials, with, as you say, a cumulative experience of 114 years, I did the math, I can do division, and that comes down to 42 years a person. Three of them quit right after 9/11 when they saw that the Fourth Amendment was under attack, and as one of them jocularly said, NSA became short for no such amendment. Anyhow, the amendment was disregarded. Three of them quit, but one stayed on. He was a new employee. His name was Tom Drake. And they had no way of knowing that Tom Drake was such a straight Arrow person. And so they gave him the idea, or they gave him the task, really, of researching what information was available to NSA before 9/11. He came with rather shattering conclusions. There was ample evidence to prevent 9/11 from ever happening. Now, the president, you mentioned that he's playing a little bit loose with the facts. In his big speech, 10 days after we had warned him about all this, he said, you know, the new program, the bulk collection, which, by the way, has never stopped any terrorist attack, the bulk collection came out of a desire to address a gap identified after 9/11. One of the 9/11 hijackers, Khalid al-Mindar, made a phone call from San Diego to a known al-Qaeda safe house in Yemen. Now, if we, that's the end of the quote. What the president is suggesting now is that if we had the bulk collection, we could have gotten that. You know, that's so disingenuous. Here's the facts. NSA knew the telephone number of this safe house in Yemen at least by 1996 and was, of course, keeping track of calls from the U.S. Now, it doesn't matter what former FBI Director Mueller, or former Vice President Cheney would have us believe. What matters is something as simple as caller ID. William Binney, one of the chief scientists at NSA before he left, has explained that automated systems take over when such calls are made, and as long as you have one valid number, I'll say one more time, as long as you have one valid number, you can obtain the other. It's caller ID. So we don't know whether it was gross ineptitude on NSA's part or whether it was deliberately withholding information, because information is power. But they had not only the calls, they had the content of the calls, and the president is either being misled, charitable explanation, or he's deliberately deceiving the American people by saying these things when they can be proven to be false, even though our mainstream press is reluctant to touch this at all. So what's the bottom line here? I incline toward the view that our president is afraid of our security services. I think this was a little bit clear right when he came on and refused to hold the torturers accountable. And now he has NSA, who has NSA, like FBI J. Edgar Hoover, has the book on Obama and Holder and everybody else, Dianne Feinstein, Mike Rogers. So, you know, it's Hoover on steroids. And whether it's afraid out of blackmail or whether it's afraid out of what security forces can do, and, you know, I have to say parenthetically that at a closed meeting, and this is from a good source, President Obama, right before the last election, said, you keep criticizing me for not being progressive enough, but don't you remember what happened to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? Now, my gloss on that is that if he was going to be that afraid of the security forces, which I would have to say, according to the latest research, did play a huge role in the assassination, not only of Martin Luther King Jr., but of President John Kennedy. If he was going to be afraid of that, he shouldn't have tried to become president. So what we have here is a situation where the president is misleading the American people. He should know better. Either he's not holding these people accountable for telling him the truth, and that's pretty clear because his national intelligence director lied under oath on the 12th of March when he was asked, is the National Security Agency collecting any data at all on millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? End quote. The answer James Clapper gave was, no, sir. Proven false 1 month later by Ed Snowden's revelations. What did Clapper do? He said, that was clearly erroneous, what I testified to. And what did the president do? Oh, yes, so James Clapper, he should have been more careful. What did the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee say? I never saw a more honest and forthright person than James Clapper. So, bottom line, they're all in this together. I pin my hopes on the judiciary Because when you get the corporations as they are, NSA corporations, NSA, the government, the Congress, when you get all those people together, you have something very close to the definition that Benito Mussolini gave to fascism.
Appreciate all the good work you're doing. Thank you for giving this enlightening insight. Ray McGovern, we look forward to our next conversation.
Most welcome.
Ray McGovern, and he has a long experience within the intelligence community. He provided intelligence for over 7 different presidential administrations, many in the CIA. His website is raymcgovern.com. I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Because we're running a little late, we'll say hello very quickly to Luann and then go right over to Utrecht Lead. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have a quick email here from a John from California, and I'm going to just give you one of his two questions. And he just downloaded your show about the dire forecast for California, and he said, why can't the U.S. use HAARP and chemtrails for good? For example, moving rain clouds over the dry western states. HAARP is usually linked with negative activities, like ensuring that a drought will hit a certain area so that a hedge fund betting on the failure of a crop will reap profits. The chemtrails I've heard have seemed to be misguided or evil, such as spreading nanoparticles of aluminum in the atmosphere that people can breathe in. Can we use that technology to help with the changing climates?
Unfortunately, you can't. Once you set into motion an adverse effect, it tips on itself. You then go into a chaos theory. So, no, it cannot. HAARP should not be even considered for using to create some beneficial weather patterns, because the entire technology should be dismantled.
I agree.
All the best.
Thank you.
Hi, Utrecht. What do you have for us today?
Hello. Today is open forum, and listeners have their say, as usual.
Great. Utrecht Lead right now.